Well, good morning, church.
Good morning.
It's great to be back home with you guys. I've been on the road the last 3 weeks down at Grace Midtown and Grace Monroe and Grace Athens. And I just want to come back and say what God's doing at each of those campuses is absolutely phenomenal. And I love the fact that we get a chance to be part of this movement of churches, this family of churches. That is daring to live the gospel of Jesus out in everyday life in ways that challenge our community and ways that change our community. So my name is Dave Rhodes, pastor of discipleship here at Grace Snellville, and glad to be with you guys this morning. I will tell you, I'm a little bit nervous this morning because I woke up in a full sweat this morning thinking that I had bombed on this talk. Like literally, it was a dream that was very vivid. I couldn't put two sentences together. I'm like, how did this happen? It was one of those nightmares that you have, like when you're in college and you wake up thinking, I've got an exam and I didn't study. I don't know how this happened, but all of a sudden, you didn't study. So I'm a little bit nervous, but I woke up this morning thinking, you know what? It's gonna be all right. Because no matter what happens in this talk, we're eating barbecue afterwards, right? And that's going to make the day good. So I just felt, really relieved on that front. So anyway, welcome to Grace this morning. Looking forward to what God says to us. I want to start this morning by replaying a quote from H. Richard Niebuhr, who wrote the groundbreaking book, Christ and Culture. In that book, Niebuhr says this. He says, the great Christian revolutions come not by the discovery of that which was not known before. They happen when someone believes radically that which has always been there. That the great Christian revolutions come with not the discovery of some new truth. They happen when someone or a group of people dare to believe radically that which has always been there. I bring that up this morning because what I have to talk to you about today is not new. But my hope is that we would continue to be a community that radically leverages our lives for this kind of truth. We're in this series, We Are Grace. It's an important conversation. Every organization, every person really has five questions that we have to answer in determining the future of who we're going to be and what we're going to do. The what question, what is it that you were put on the planet to do? The why question, why or who are you? The how question, how are you going to do it? The when question, when am I successful? The where question, where am I going? And these are important questions to bring underneath the lordship of Jesus. That we let Jesus determine our what and our why and our how and our when and our where. And they're important for us as individuals and as organizations, as churches, because too many times in our lives, we just spend our lives answering that fifth question, where are we going? And the problem is, if you haven't answered the first four questions, then you become a slave to the latest opportunity in your life. And so it's the what question and the why question and the how question and the when question that are important markers for us. And this summer, we've been answering that why question. Why Grace? Who are we as a group of people? What makes our tribe unique? And we've made some defining statements when we said we are pioneers. We are family. We are worshipers. We are dreamers. And today we come to reaffirm we are neighbors. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for who you are. Thank you for the goodness with which you have neighbored to us. And the opportunity and invitation that we have with our lives to neighbor with others. I pray this morning, God, that you would bring this simple truth into radical belief in our lives. We love you. In your name, amen. If you have your Bible this morning, we're going to be in Galatians chapter 5. You can go ahead and open that up. If you don't have a Bible, raise your hand. We'll put a Bible in your hand. The guys will pass the Bible cards. If you don't have a Bible, we would love for you to take it home as our gift to you. But we're going to anchor down in Galatians chapter 5, beginning in verse 13 this morning. 6 million people, 1.5 million children. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go to Israel and to walk in the footsteps of Jesus, to go to the different sites and to just kind of be where Jesus was, to be on the Sea of Galilee, to go to Capernaum and Jerusalem. It was an amazing trip, one that we take here on a regular basis called Epic. Is a great thing. If you haven't been to Israel, I just recommend that you be part of this conversation that we have on a regular basis. And I can remember things like being out on the Sea of Galilee and the guy doing his hands like this and basically saying 80% of the gospel happened between my two hands. And there were so many incredible sights that every day it just woke up and it was just like having a new adventure. But there was one sight that struck me almost as much as any other sight. It wasn't an old sight, but to be honest, a rather new one. It was the day that we headed to Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Memorial Center there in Jerusalem. And as I walked the halls of that memorial center, you began to read the stories of the 6 million people who died in the shadows of World War I and World War II as Nazi Germany tried to exterminate an entire group of people. As I walked the halls, this wasn't something necessarily that was new to me. I'd studied this before. And yet, with a all too fragrant reality, as I heard the stories and looked into the faces of the people who had survived this tragic set of events, it was one of those moments that was deeply moving for me. I began to ask, how does this kind of thing happen? As I walked the halls, what I began to see was the storyline became pretty clear. That no one wakes up one morning and thinks, let's kill 6 million people. But that the process that is kind of behind that kind of deal is one that starts when you begin to demonize a group of people, meaning that you begin to think the worst of them. And then once you demonize them, you can dehumanize them. You can begin to rob them about what's best of them. And then once you dehumanize them, it's easy to destroy them. You just burn whatever is left of them. And as I walked those halls, I could just see this storyline. First, the demonization, the thinking of what's worst of a group of people. And then that process of dehumanization where they rob them first of their jobs and then of their homes and then of their names. They just became a number. And then eventually robbed them of their lives. One of the most moving parts was walking into the children's memorial, where literally in a display of art, 1.5 million candles built by reflections are lit for the 1.5 million children that died during these tragic events. And 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the names of the children are being read. They do this because the children would have no lasting legacy. And so they read their names to keep their memory alive. It takes 3 years to get through the list of names. I bring that up this morning because even though we may not be in danger of a Holocaust, I do believe these same kinds of forces are well and alive in our world. That we live in a world today where there's so much violence, our kids are afraid almost to even go to school. And yet the storyline between some of the horrific events that we've experienced in the last several years is this same storyline where someone is demonized and then they're dehumanized and then they're destroyed and they retaliate with another demonization and dehumanization and destruction. In the immigration crisis that we find ourselves in as a country today, we see these same kinds of forces. We demonize, dehumanize. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, you find a way to demonize the other side and dehumanize the other side and then try to destroy. We face this at a macro issue, but the truth, we face it at a micro issue. It's easy to say the world is broken. What's hard to say is that I'm broken. And yet what so easily and naturally happens to me when my neighbor mows his grass in the wrong way or puts his trash out in the wrong way, I demonize him. And then I dehumanize him. And I think about ways that I can destroy him. I mean, why is he mowing there? Is he making a statement about the boundary lines of our property? Or even with my relationship with my wife, Kim. If she doesn't do what I want her to do, it's easy to demonize, think the worst of, dehumanize, and then destroy. And it's into this kind of cycle that the Bible gives us a surprising solve. That the solve to this kind of broken cycle that continues to help broken people break people, that the call to neighboring changes things. That the call to learn a name and a story, to enter into a conversation, sets a new cycle into place. See, I think that even in our own neighborhoods, too many times we dehumanize our neighbors when they just become a street address. We don't know their names. We have no ideas about their stories, let alone enter into a conversation. And yet it's into this kind of world that Jesus and now Paul's surprising solve is one of learning to be a neighbor. The book of Galatians, which we're going to anchor into today, was written to a group of people that were a fledgling and kind of floundering church in Galatia. Galatia was one of the most violent places in the ancient world. This is Afghanistan or Compton, California. It's the kind of place that you don't walk down without keeping an eye over your shoulder for what might happen to you. 90% of the population was slaves. This is the place where Paul and John Mark and Barnabas were headed when Paul says we're going to Galatia, that John Mark says, not me, I'm heading home to mom. And yet Paul says this is the kind of place that actually needs the gospel. We've got to go move into this place for a season. We've got to go neighbor here and share the story of Jesus. And the gospel is always the same wherever you go. The gospel is always the birth, life, death, burial, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. But what the gospel means is always multifaceted, that whatever context you come into, the birth, life, death, burial, resurrection, ascension of Jesus takes on a different kind of meaning. And in Galatia, where 90% of the people are slaves, of course, the gospel means freedom. Of course it does. What else could it mean but freedom? And yet what you find in the book of Galatians is that this church that is dealing with the gospel of Jesus and this call to be free are still struggling with their slave mentality. And so there's one group of people who just think, well, what it means to be free is just do anything that you want to do. And there's another group of people that say, no, what it means to be free is to be a slave of the law. And it's into this kind of world that Paul begins to actually set forth a different kind of solution, this idea of neighboring, this idea of love. Now, the big thought this morning as we read this that I just want to pull out to you is this: neighboring is giving my best for God's best in you. Neighboring happens when I leverage my best for God's best in you, when you leverage your best for God's best in others. So we're going to pick Paul up here at chapter 5, verse 13, and listen to his call for freedom. He says it this way, "For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another." Paul, writing this group of people, says, I'm writing to you because I want you to be free. But you need to understand what freedom is. Freedom is not the ability to do anything you want to do. Can I just tell you that today? Freedom is not the ability to do anything you want to do. If that's freedom, I know a lot of people who are doing anything they want to do that find themselves in incredible captivity. Freedom is not the ability to do anything you want to do. Freedom is the capability of becoming who you were always destined to be. Let me say that again. Freedom is about the capability of becoming who you were always destined to be. In Ephesians chapter 2, Paul's writing to the church at Ephesus, this universal letter, and he says, here's what the gospel does. Not only does it free you from your sin, but it frees you to become yourself. He says that you are God's workmanship, God's poem. The word there is poema, God's masterpiece, created to do good works, which God prepared in advance for you to do. In other words, God's been having a dream about your life from the beginning of time, and part of what the gospel does is it recovers the God dream in your life. That no matter what you've done, what you've been through, what's happened to you, God hasn't given up on that dream. And freedom is the capability of becoming who God's always destined you to be. And so Paul is writing to the Galatian church saying, you got to understand, God hasn't given up on that kind of thing. But the pathway, the principle in which this freedom takes place is that it happens as you begin to love your neighbor as yourself. This is the radical simplicity of Jesus. It is not simplistic. Don't confuse simplistic with simplicity. Simplicity is what happens on the other side of complexity. Simplistic is what happens when you're afraid to go through complexity. Mark chapter 12, this principle has resonance in the person of Jesus himself when he's asked, out of all the commandments, 613 commands, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus, with striking simplicity, makes this profound statement. He says, the greatest command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And then he says, in case you want to know what number two is, here's number two. And love your neighbor as yourself. He ties Leviticus chapter 19, verse 8 with Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. And he says, this is what the law is all about. You want to know how to fulfill the law. You want to know how to totally summarize all 613 commandments. He said, here's what it's about. It's about loving God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself. And the genius of this is that in this moment, Jesus eliminates the us and them mentality. There's not those and us, because if I'm loving as myself, it's we. And yet he's making it increasingly clear what John will pull out in his epistle to say, how can we say we love God who we can't see if we can't love our brother that we can't see? The demonstration of our love for God is our love for each other. That it's our love for the neighbor beside us that demonstrates whether we're the people of God or not. And so the principle is this, that we're to love our neighbor as ourselves. But the question is this, all right, then how do I do that? Because that's something that says easy and does hard. It's easy to agree with and hard to live out. And it's this process that Paul begins to work out in the verses that follow. Verse 16, he's continuing his conversation. He says, but I say, walk by the Spirit and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the spirit, and the desires of the spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things that you want to do. But if you are led by the spirit, you're not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are evident: sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and the like. Sounds like the nightly news, right? He says, I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not enter the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is, not the fruits of the Spirit are, the fruit of the Spirit is love. And the rest you can think of as a manifestation of love: joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step by the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. So Paul says, if you really want to be free, that the way to freedom is through neighboring. And that the process of neighboring and loving, it happens when I give my best for God's best in you. That the way that I'm loving you is if I'm offering my best for God's best in your life. And that the pathway to doing that is to be someone who's filled with the Spirit. In other words, the mark of the New Testament church was not simply their creed. It wasn't what they said they believed. The mark of the New Testament church was this: are they filled with the Spirit? Is there something supernatural about this person's life? Are the fruit of the Spirit manifesting in their life? It's not about what you give intellectual assent to. The question is, what kinds of things are coming out of your life? And Paul says, someone who's filled with the Spirit is someone who's got love, joy, peace, goodness coming out of their life. And if we're going to be those kinds of people, and this is what we're affirming, we're not saying we want to be neighbors, we're saying we are neighbors here at Grace. That pathway is one of being filled by the Spirit, and being filled with the Spirit really brings us into two battlefronts. First, there's the battle inside of us. It's the battle within. It's the battle for what we're free from. In Paul's language here, he calls this the battle between our flesh and God's Spirit. Flesh is me at my worst. Spirit is me at God's best. And there's this tension in your life. There's this tension in my life between me at my worst and me at God's best, that I've got this shadow side of me that wants to rob you. See, what I've got to admit is that there's this part of me, it's me at my worst, that wants to rob you of your best. And yet there's this other piece that is the Spirit of God, that's me at God's best, that wants to leverage my best for God's best in you. And these two things are in conflict. There's the flesh and the Spirit, and for all of us who are believers, these things bring us into battle inside of ourselves. And so the question in Galatia is this: how do we deal with this? And the first answer is the law, that if we could just keep the law, then we could win this battle. And Paul is writing to say the law is not a bad thing. In fact, Jesus would say, I haven't come to destroy or abolish the law, but to fulfill it. The law is not a bad thing, but the weakness of the law is this. The weakness of the law is that it can only point out me at my worst. It can't inspire me to God's best. In other words, the law is written to keep me from my nightmare, but it will never inspire God's dream in my life. That the law is built to demonstrate to me when I am acting less than human. I mean, think about it. The Ten Commandments, these are not the highest aspirations of humanity, are they? God's looking at humanity saying, hey, could you try not to kill one another? I think that would be a good idea. Hey, could you not steal his stuff? You know what would be awesome? If you didn't sleep with her husband. This is not the ceiling of humanity. This is the floor of humanity, right? God's saying, it's in this that I'm just teaching you how to be human, how to not be less than human. And so the law in our life acts as a referee. It points out when we are living less than human. I know you've experienced this. You experience it every time that a cop pulls out behind you when you're driving. And all of a sudden, you know, you've gone from laid back to 10 and 2, right? And you're like, did I renew my license, please? Is there a warrant out for my arrest? I'm not sure right now. And at night, it doesn't have to be a cop, does it? It can be any car with a luggage rack on top of it, right? Because it's like 10 and 2, is it a cop? Is it a cop? That's what the law does. It points out what's wrong. But it can never inspire God's best. Which, by the way, church, it's why no law will ever change culture in the way the gospel can. It's not that laws are bad things. We need to work so that we do not become less than human in our country, but you want to know what the hope of the world is. It's not that we just keep laws or write new laws. The hope of the world is a people who decide to live their life filled by the Spirit. Because where the law is a referee, the Spirit of God is a coach. Where the law tries to manage me at my worst, the Spirit brings out God's best in me. That's what a coach does. And so Paul says, if you'll live your life filled by the Spirit, if you'll allow the Spirit of God to bring out God's best in you, then the way he says it is, against such things there is no law. So he says, if you live your life filled by the Spirit, you don't have to worry about fulfilling the law. I remember when I was learning to play golf, one of my first jobs that I ever got was I was the guy at the range who was picking up all the range balls. I was the guy that everyone was hitting at. You know that guy. But it meant that I got free golf lessons from the pro that was there. And I'll never forget the pro, you know, teaching me how to play golf. And he says it this way. He says, Dave, if he's trying to teach me how to do the mental side of golf. He says, if I tell you not to think about an orange, what do you think about? An orange, right? And so if you get up on the tee and you say, don't slice, don't slice, don't slice, don't slice, you're going to slice. He says, instead of trying not to think about an orange, what if I told you think about a banana? Because if you think about a banana, not only are you thinking about a banana, but you're not thinking about an orange anymore, right? So he says, when you get up on the tee box, don't think about all the things that you want, don't want to do. Don't say, don't hit it in the water, don't slice, don't do that. Think about the shot that you want to hit. This is what Paul is talking about here. He's saying, if you're filled by the Spirit, if you're in step with the Spirit, if you're allowing the Spirit to be your coach, then you don't got to think about all the things that you're not supposed to do. Instead, by keeping your mind on heavenly things, by being the kind of person who's filled with the Spirit, not only do you fulfill the law, not only do you stop being your own worst nightmare, but you begin to become God's dream. So that means that the battlefield inside of us is one of saying, what are you setting your mind on? What are you filling your body with? What are you filling your mind with? See, it's no coincidence that if you fill your mind with pornography, you struggle with intimacy in your relationships. If you fill your mind with violence, you struggle with peace. If you fill your mind with consumerism, you struggle with contentment. And what Paul is saying is that there's a real battle going on inside all of us. And the battle inside is won by being filled with the Spirit. But there's a second battle. It's not just a battle within us. There's the battle outside of us. That God's goodness, God bringing out his best in me, in you, has not done its work fully until it gets outside of you and me. That God's best in me is meant to be leveraged to bring out God's best in you. that God's best in you is meant to be leveraged to bring out God's best in others. And in fact, that we're not to be hoarders of God's best, but part of what it means to be a follower of Jesus is when God's best in you is leveraged for God's best in somebody else. In other words, he's saying that we don't need to be hoarders of God's best. I was thinking about how to demonstrate this to you today, so I brought in a couple things because I think this challenges us right at our definition of Christian maturity and really our definition of righteousness. By the way, did you notice what's not a fruit of the Spirit? Rightness is not a fruit of the Spirit. Because you can be right and bad. Goodness is. And so Paul is telling us about what it looks like to be righteous, and righteous is not simply not breaking the rules. It's about building relationships. The mark of your righteousness is not about the rules that you keep, but the right standing of relationships that you're in. That it's your relationships that tell you about your righteousness. And in the process of thinking about that, Paul redefines maturity. Because a lot of times what we begin to think is that maturity is just about getting a bigger cup. If I can just get more and more of God, then that's what it means to be a mature Christian. And so I started out last year with this small cup, and this was my capacity. And then, you know, I did some Bible studies, and I got a bigger cup. And eventually, I'm going to worship every day of the week. I've got a huge cup. And we begin to think that Christian maturity is this. If I could just listen to one more sermon, if I could just hear one more worship song, if I could just get more and more and more of God. But I want to suggest to you, this is not maturity. This is called addiction. I struggle with this with the Diet Coke, but that's a different issue. That when Paul talks about maturity, he's saying it's not about getting a bigger cup, it's becoming a pitcher. That you are not made to just simply be a container of God's goodness, but that you were built with a handle and a spout, and that God's goodness that's poured into you is made complete when it begins to be poured out of you. That Christian maturity isn't about just getting a bigger cup, it's about becoming a pitcher. By the way, guys, you need to know this is the kind of philosophy that undermines all that we do here in adult ministries. The reason we do communities and not simply Bible studies is that we don't want you just to become a bigger cup. Now, it doesn't mean, it does not mean we don't want you to study the Bible. We do. But I want you to study the Bible for someone, not just to get a bigger cup for yourself. I want you to become the kind of person that says, you know what? There's something happening in my neighborhood, and my neighborhood needs the gospel. And so, yeah, we're going to get together, and we're going to eat meals. And yes, we're going to study the Bible, but we do not exist for ourselves. We exist for our neighborhoods. We're going to dare to be the subversive movement of Jesus underneath the surface of our community. And we're studying the Bible, but it's not just simply for us, because sometimes people will never read the Bible, but they will read our lives. And so what we've said here at Grace is that we are neighbors, that we're not just simply coming to church to have another experience, but we're coming to church because we believe that everyone here is a missionary. We believe that everyone here is a pastor, that your neighborhood needs a pastor, that your neighborhood needs a community, that your neighborhood needs a movement of people who dare to be filled by the Spirit of God and dare to imagine what the gospel might look like when it intersects the people around you. The book, The Art of Neighboring, gives us this challenge. They ask the question, the four neighbors to the right of you, the four neighbors to the left of you, the four neighbors across the street from you, do you know their names? Could you tell their story? Do you know anything significant that's happening in their lives? And in their research, 90% of people don't even know their neighbors' names. Now, I gotta tell you, this is not something I've fully arrived at. My wife is way better at this than I am. I mean, she has been the gospel in our neighborhood at our bus stop. I'm amazed by the way that she knows people's stories and their names. I'm always like, can you remind me of their name again? But what Paul is saying is this. He's saying, you want to be free in your life? You want to live out God's best in your life? Here's the bottom line. Dare to love your neighbor as yourself. And what if we just took that literally for a moment? Church, this is who we've decided to be. This is what we are affirming together, that we're the church that's going to be in Clarkston. We're going to move into the neighborhood. We're going to dare to be the church that is going to be a gospel presence in that community. That we're the church that's going to dare to engage friendship with our Muslim brothers and sisters, because we say that part of that is not just simply for them, it's for us to become human again. That it's about us being filled with the Spirit and engaging conversations, learning a name, hearing a story, that this is what we do because we know no law can change the country, but the church can. And we say we will be that church because we are Grace and we are neighbors. You want to know who we are? We are neighbors. We are neighbors. This is the call. This is the pathway to freedom. This is the path to rehumanization that breaks the cycle of demonizing, dehumanizing, and destroying. And it's the call of Jesus. This is exactly what Jesus said in his parable, right? Good Samaritan. By the way, we're the ones who call it the Good Samaritan. For Jesus, there's a guy walking from Jerusalem to Jericho. And there's this dangerous road, just like Galatia. And there's some robbers, and the robbers beat him and take everything from him and leave him within a half inch of his life. And there's a priest and a Levite. These are the lawgivers. These are the law keepers. And the Greek there is they go and look at him, but then they keep walking. And then there's the Samaritan. You always got to watch out for the third guy in Jesus' parable. It's like a priest, a rabbi, and a Baptist pastor going to a bar. You just got to watch out for that. It's an unlikely villain or unlikely hero. It's the Samaritan. It's this immigrant, this potential terrorist that walks by. And he picks him up, and he puts him on his donkey. And the picture here is that he's leading the donkey. He takes the form of a servant. And he takes him to the hotel and he says, everything this guy needs is on me. And if he has any other expenses, I'll pay when I get back. See, in that parable, there are three postures. There's the posture of the robbers, and their mantra is this, what's yours is mine. And there's the keepers, and the mantra of the keepers is, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours. And then there's the mantra of the giver who says, what's yours is mine. You want to change the world, church. You want to become Grace in the world. It's to live your life not with the mantra of what's yours is mine, or what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours. But to dare to get into the radical movement of grace, which also means gift, that says this, what's mine is yours. Max DePree, one more story and we'll be done today. Max DePree was a leadership guru that gave incredible articulation to the scope of leadership in our world. He wrote a book called The Art of Leadership. And one story that Max would tell was that long before he was a leadership guru, he was a paramedic in World War II. And as a paramedic in World War II, it meant that after the war would be fought each day, they would go out into the battlefield and they would work on all the soldiers that were still clinging to life in the midst of death. He said this meant that they would look after not just the Allied soldiers, but also the German soldiers that were struggling for their life, because as paramedics, they were just trying to help everyone live. And as part of what they would do, they would bring with them vials of blood, because people on the battlefield would often need a blood transfusion. And as part of the moral deal of that day in America, when everyone would give blood, they would attach the name of the person who had donated that vial of blood so that the soldiers would know who had saved their life on the battlefield. As part of his paramedic duty, he said this wasn't U.S. policy by any means, just him and a couple of friends began to do it. They began to hold back the vials of blood that had Jewish last names to give to the German soldiers. Don't you love that, by the way? So they would come upon a German soldier who was dying, and they would say, you know that you're going to die, but I have the power to save your life. And then they would ask him this question, will you receive the blood of this Jewish donor? He said, sometimes they would say yes. Oftentimes they would curse and say, I'll never do that. He said, in those moments, they'd let him pass out and save their life with it anyway. But I want to bring the sermon down to that picture this morning, because really what we're asking is this, not just will you receive the blood of this Jewish donor named Jesus, but will you receive his spirit? We dare to continue being the church that says in a world that's demonizing and dehumanizing and destroying, we will create a different kind of movement. We will learn a name and a story. We will engage ourselves in a conversation because we are grace and we are neighbors. Let's pray. So as we pray this morning, these two battles are real in our own lives. And some of us are struggling on the battle inside. Others of us are struggling on the battle outside. But part of what we do as Christians is come to a common table to receive the blood and body of Jesus in the form of bread and wine. And so this morning as we worship, we just continue to invite you to the table as just a place to signify. We're going to have some tables here at the front that if you want to be part of, you just can come and just dip the cracker in the juice. It's just a way of saying, I'm accepting the blood, the spirit of this Jewish donor. If you want to worship at your seat, you can do that. There's nothing hyper-spiritual. It's just simply, I just want to worship and just say, you know, I want, Spirit of God, for you to flow in me and through me freely. And I don't want my flesh to win. And so church, I'm going to pray here in just a moment, but we're just inviting you to respond this morning in your seat or away from your seat. This reaffirmation. I love preaching this message at Grace because it's not a call to something we haven't been, but simply a reaffirmation of who we are. So God, we come to you as a church this morning that is on this path. We don't always do it perfect. There are places that we still want to see shaped and changed by the gospel. But we come to align ourselves with who you are, and you are a God who gave your best for our best. For God so loved the world that he gave. He moved into the neighborhood. He took the form of a servant. That Jesus, you were the first good Samaritan. That you refused to let us be a number or a street address, but you moved into our neighborhood. You got to know our names. You heard our stories and made our story part of your story. So God, we come as a church saying that's the kind of church that we choose to be. And whether we're in Midtown or Monroe or Washington, D.C., or here at Grace Snellville, we will be neighbors. We will be marked by our love because we choose to be those who are filled with the Spirit. We love you, Lord. In your name. Amen.